From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a bad patch for the American economy and American politics. Low growth, gridlocked government. The two are not unrelated, says my guest today, Harvard economist Benjamin Friedman. And despite the Dow at a five-year high this week, we haven't broken the impasse yet. This hour on Point, hard times, bad politics, and how to break out of the cycle. You can join the conversation. Were we better, more nimble, more open when the economy was better? How do we get back to that? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Benjamin Friedman, economist, professor of political economy at Harvard University. Back in 2005, he wrote a big book called The Moral Consequences of Economic Growth. The book's getting a lot of attention right now in our hour of polarization and gridlocked politics. Benjamin Friedman, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here. Did you imagine 8 years ago when you came out with this that we'd be in a pickle like this today where your work might be so relevant?
I certainly meant the book to be a statement not just about that moment in time when I wrote it, but something that people would come back to as relevant for many years to come. That was the objective, and I'm pleased to see that people are looking at it now. But I'm sorry that we're looking at it in this particular kind of circumstance, and I certainly can't take any credit for predicting the economic stagnation we're having now. For an economist, it would be lovely to be able to claim that kind of prescience, but the answer is 8 years ago, that was before the financial crisis. Did I see it coming? No.
Let's look at the sunny side of your thesis first. We'll go to the hard times and bad politics, but you put forward here this construct that good times make for good politics, progressive policies, advancement in societies, cultures, polities. Make that case for us.
The main argument that I made and that I still believe is that when the broad bulk of the society's population has a sense of forward progress in its material standard of living, and when people are optimistic that this forward progress will continue and even have reason to believe that their children after them will likewise be moving forward in the material realm, that's the circumstance in which, not just in America, but in one country after another over history, it's turned out that the society has been able to make forward progress also in other dimensions that Western thinking has since the Enlightenment of the 18th century regarded as positive in moral terms. I have in mind things like generosity and fairness, commitment to democracy, tolerance with respect to what? As an American, I would immediately think of race relations. Mm-hmm. I would think of attitude towards foreigners. But I also had in mind things like ethnic prejudice, religious tension. In all of these dimensions, I think the record is clear that when the bulk of the society is experiencing a sense of forward material progress, the society also makes progress, not every time, not every bit, but on the whole in these other dimensions of its existence. And conversely, and this is the unfortunate circumstance in which we find ourselves at the moment, conversely, when the bulk of the population loses a sense of moving ahead economically and loses, too, a sense of optimism that that forward economic progress is likely to return anytime soon, that's the condition in which not only isn't there a lot of forward progress, but there's also often rigidification, retrenchment, resistance. And sometimes that turns out historically to have had very disastrous consequences for individual countries and, as in the case of Germany in the 30s, for example, for other countries as well. So there are major league issues at stake here.
Give us some examples from the record, as you say, of each of these sort of sunny times in this country or elsewhere and the social outcomes that you see in your review, dark times and the outcomes.
Here's an example that should resonate with the public debate today. Let's talk about immigration and attitudes toward immigrants. Mm-hmm. So ask the following set of questions. Why did the United States experience in the 1850s this wave of anti-immigrant violence? And why did that violence go away, which it certainly did?
Are we talking toward Asian immigrants in that way?
No,
or where?
No. Here in Boston, it's
Irish.
very much worth pointing out that the immigration in those days was in part Irish. Mm-hmm. This was the period after the potato famine mm-hmm. in Ireland, but it was also heavily from places like Germany mm-hmm. in northern Europe. Mm-hmm. So we had this wave of anti-immigrant violence, but it went away in the good economic times after the Civil War. And then why did we have the return in the 1880s and 1890s, not of violence, but of really ugly anti-immigrant agitation? Why did that go away by the mid-90s? And then we had this period on up through the First World War of opening the borders and welcoming immigrants. To use the vocabulary of that day, people mm-hmm. were Americanizing immigrants. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, that Americanization movement had lots of positive fallout. That's where the movement toward a universal high school education came from. As of 1900, only 6% of Americans had adult Americans had high school educations. But if the program was to welcome and Americanize all of these immigrants, there had to be some vehicle, some mechanism for doing it, and the chosen vehicle was a high school education.
And you see the backdrop to that more generous, more open-minded attitude as better economic times.
Yes, absolutely. What we're talking about is the poor economic times of the 1850s and then followed by an economic boom. Remember the Transcontinental Railroad, mm-hmm. things like that after the Civil War, but then turning to what was at that time called the Great Depression. If you had used the phrase Great Depression mm-hmm. in 1900, of course, people wouldn't have known about the 1930s. They would have thought you were talking about the 1880s and the first half of the 1890s. And it had this effect. And then just continuing forward with the same line of argument, why did this Americanization opening wave disappear after World War I? We had this extremely restrictive and discriminatory legislation, the most restrictive anti-immigrant legislation we've ever had, and very discriminatory. Then coming, leaping forward, why did all that get thrown out after World War II? We had this long economic boom after the war, mm-hmm. and that led to a liberalization of immigration policies.
And this is all just on the immigration vector.
We could talk about race mm-hmm. relations. Mm-hmm. We could talk about generosity to the poor. We could talk about details of the democracy, like when did women get the vote? When did blacks get the vote? When did blacks really get the vote?
Better times, better outcomes. Bring that historian's view right up to date then. Apply it to what you see in front of us right now in this last half dozen years.
Well, I would go back more than a half dozen years, Tom. The mm-hmm. basic fact with which we are struggling is that the majority of American families today have had no increase in their living standards and incomes since 1996. That's a decade and a half of stagnation. Mm-hmm. And this clearly is not just a matter of the financial crisis. Even before the crisis hit in 2007, there was basically stagnation for the majority of American families. The family right in the middle of the American income distribution was earning in today's dollars $66,300 as of 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2007, mm-hmm. that's on the eve of the financial crisis, they'd gone all the way from $66,300 to $66,600.
Barely moved. So
almost nothing. And now, of course, with the financial crisis and the economic downturn, incomes have fallen. The last year for which we have data is 2011. Incomes are down to $61,000 for the average family. And as a result, we're back where we were in 1996.
So do you see the shadow of that falling across our politics, our society?
Yeah, I certainly do. I think we see it in the nasty tone of our politics. I think we see it in this bizarre stalemate that we have over things that never used to get in the way. Look at the big news item today is that the Republicans finally agreed to suspend the debt ceiling limitation for another 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it always used to be that the debt ceiling limitation extension, which happens all the time, was an opportunity for people to make their substantive points, and then the country moved on. And now we're in this odd situation in which every time the debt ceiling limitation is reached, which is quite frequently, one party or the other, and could be the Democrats next time. I'm not trying to be make this a partisan thing. One party or the other has the opportunity to impede the entire progress of government.
Maybe our substantive reality has changed. I mean, the case that gets made is we just can't go further. The debt's too big.
Well, yes, but the issue is how to deal with that. And I think the presidential campaign is a good example. Most people are aware that the big problem for the U.S. government is Medicare. For listeners who are not aware of the distinction, I'm not talking about Medicaid, which is the medical care for the indigent, but rather Medicare, which is the care for the retired elderly. This is going to break the bank. Nobody in the campaign had anything useful to say about it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about slow growth, hard times, and our ugly politics right now. My guest says they're all linked. Good times, good politics. Bad times, bad politics. Harvard economist Benjamin Friedman wrote the book that a lot of people are citing right now called The Moral Consequences of Economic Growth. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. In his inauguration speech, second one on Monday, President Obama was referring to just this kind of dynamic and maybe a way out.
Progress does not compel us to settle centuries-long debates about the role of government for all time, but it does require us to act in our time. For now, decisions are upon us, and we cannot afford delay. We cannot mistake absolutism for principle, or substitute spectacle for politics, or treat name-calling as reasoned debate. We must act.
The president on Monday. Benjamin Friedman is with me in the studio, economics professor of political economy at Harvard. So what did you hear? Many people listen to that speech and they say, hey, here's the progressive agenda. It's the liberal Obama. He's there. He's ready to roll. Forget that compromise idea of the first term. It didn't work. Republicans didn't want to have anything to do with it. So here we go. Is this a breakout from the kind of triple reverse trap you describe or not?
Well, Mr. Obama seems, on the basis of his speech, clearly to be trying a different strategy. The question then is whether he's going to succeed. That's really a question, I suppose, more for political scientists than for an economist. But the basic reality you and I have been discussing is going to be here for a while. The typical American has been stuck for more than a decade and a half now in a period of no economic advance, and this sours people's moods, and it also limits resources. If we had a growing economy, which we don't, then people might say, what are we going to do with the fruits of that growth? Might we use it to shore up the plight of the poor? Might we make advances in technology in a particular way? Might we reform our K through 12 education? There's no lack of progress.
Or pay down a little debt.
No lack of projects, but we don't have a lot of means with which to do those things.
Well, Steve writes to us, a listener online, Benjamin Friedman. He says, this isn't rocket science. When there was plenty of money to go around, everybody got a piece of the pie. Now we're told resources are limited, so we'll have to accept smaller pieces. Some people are afraid they won't get their share. Others are concerned they won't get any at all. small? I mean, is this just about the size of the pie and how we respond to that?
I think he's very right, but it's not, to me, just about the size of the pie, as you put it. It's about whether there's growth or not. The heart of my work is about how people react to questions like, am I living better today than I remember growing up in my parents' house? For young people, what are the opportunities available to me compared to what my aunts and uncles had starting out? A little later on, how am I raising my children compared to what I grew up knowing? For people my age, it's things like, what are the opportunities for my children compared to what my career was about? So it's not just as this listener, I think much of what the listener says is right on target, but it's not just about the size of what he calls the pie. It's about whether people's circumstances are moving forward or not. There's a difference between stagnation and forward progress that alters people's attitudes. That, I think, is the heart of the matter.
Does the historical record find people wrapping more tightly around ideology when they don't have that sense of forward motion?
Yes, it certainly does. Take another example that was in the paper just the other day, the number of so-called patriot groups that have been founded has shot way up in the last couple of years. It was high, as we know, during the 1980s and especially in the early 90s, the economic downturn then. But then throughout the course of the 90s and on into the 2000s, it went away. Now, I wouldn't say we're at a record high. The data in the paper didn't show whether that's true or not. But there's been a dramatic increase in the last couple of years. Now, that's about as clear a case of a sharp reactionary ideology as
you can imagine. What kind of group is it that you mean?
We're talking about people who put on military, private groups who put on military fatigues and go out to do military exercises in the field, not again as part of the National Guard, but as private military groups. And then one has to ask, well, what exactly is it that they think they're defending the country from? Is that the notion that, to use their vocabulary, black helicopters are from the UN are going to come? We see the very fractious debate now over an attempt to limit, even in very small ways, the availability of enormous ranges of weapons. Is it that people are afraid that their access to having guns will be taken away?
But how does this translate into our politics? I mean, let's say that we got a burst of economic growth. Do you think that would really translate into different policies being pushed in Washington? There are big interest groups with large interests who appear to be pushing a lot of congressmen lately to stick up for their interests. Does that really change?
No. The question is how effective they are. The question is not whether interest groups go away. They don't. The question is not whether extreme ideology goes away. It doesn't. The question is not whether, to take another example, bigotry against blacks, against racial group, religious groups, against foreigners. These things don't go away. The question is what role they play. And the record seems to show that most of the time in many places, including our country, when the population is experiencing a sustained economic stagnation, these what I would call pathologies tend to emerge to the fore. They become dominant. And by contrast, it's not that everybody in a period of economic growth decides, oh, I'm just delighted to have my next door neighbor be from some other racial group.
I'm so open-minded.
It's rather that people are able to and do put these things aside. They, instead of having these kinds of tensions rank number one and number two in people's minds, maybe they rank number four and number five.
Benjamin Friedman wrote The Moral Consequences of Economic Growth. The book is back in the dialogue right now, given our economy and our politics. Let's go to Michael in Columbia, South Carolina. Michael, you're on with Benjamin Friedman.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
As I'm listening to your conversation, I'm hearing a lot about this two-party system, the Democrats and Republicans, but originally when we come to this country, I don't know if the Democrats and Republicans were part of the system. If you have an issue, let's say gun control, and you only have a two-party system, well, it's going to be a polarized debate on either side. Either you're going to be for it or you're going to be against it. immigration for it or against it, and there's no real way other way to go if you have a three-party system or a no-party system where you're just voting on the person based on what they believe, not what a whole entire party believes. There's more leeway, more
flexibility. I mean, Michael, I hear you. On the other hand, we've had a two-party system for a long time, and we haven't always had this degree of rigidity, to use Benjamin Friedman's word. But I'll put that to him. I take your point, and I'm glad for your call. Let me get one more first. Raymond in Montreal is calling. Raymond, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Although I'm in Montreal, I lived and worked in the U.S. for many years before I retired.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought about these things for most of my life. I'm in my 60s. I'm not convinced, or I'm not all that persuaded by Professor Friedman's analysis of these things. It kind of begs the question to say that, well, in bad economic times, bad behavior is worsened. The point is, why is the bad behavior there? And bad political behavior is always with us, and it tends to exhibit itself, in my view, as a function of the underlying character of a particular culture. Everybody cites the Germans, World War II, a population went along with horrors, as if it's entirely surprising, but of course there was a history there, there were other forces at work, there was what is now the unpopular term, a national character. America has a national character, whether it's unpleasant to say so or not, and idiocy is always with us. I don't know what value it serves to simply say, well, you know, in bad economic times, unpleasant people are increasingly more unpleasant. So what? What do you do about it?
Well, but if it leads to gridlock, if it leads to policy that's so rigid that it doesn't deal with the realities that we're confronted with, doesn't that make it consequential if bad times bring what you call, what the Professor Friedman calls bad characteristics to the fore?
Well, it's consequential, but it's kind of difficult to unload all of Congress's paralysis under the rubric of economics. Bad economic times is insufficient to explain why these people behave as they do. It's not economics that people insist that Barack Obama is not an American, that they want his long-form birth certificate. It's not economics that windbag Donald Trump wants his university transcripts. That's not economics. That's something else. There's an underlying strain in the nation, not individually, collectively. There are underlying strains that simply never go away. To say that they're just somewhat worse when economic times are bad fails to offer an explanation as to why it's there at all.
Raymond, let us pick it up. Benjamin Friedman, the two pieces there. Two-party system, therefore you're going to have polarization baked in the cake. And then even deeper, we have these traits. They're there. Let's deal with them beyond the economic, sort of graph of the moment.
Let's talk first about whether the two-party system makes things worse. The answer is I don't know. I'm not a political scientist. In the book that I wrote some years ago, I did look not just at the United States but at other Western democracies. I looked in some detail at the experience in Britain, in France, and in Germany. And if it's true that those countries not having the kind of two-party system that we do made their experience different, I didn't notice it. That is to say, we, as the caller pointed out, have had a two-party system for a long time and with the same two parties now since 1856, but the British have not. The British have had a two-party system often, but not always. Mm. The French often have not had a two-party system, and the Germans have not. And from the perspective of the things that we're talking about here, it wasn't evident to me that there was a difference between the U.S. And these other democracies in that regard. But to repeat, I'm not a political scientist and don't pretend to be. Now, the caller from Canada raises a whole variety of interesting issues. And to be clear, the last thing I would try to do is to pretend that economics is all you need to know about to address such questions as why racism exists in the first place, or why people engage in other kinds of pathological either attitudes or behaviors, that's not something that would occur to me to do. So his point about how this line of analysis doesn't tell you why things like racism are there in the first place, he's absolutely right. The question I'm addressing is why things happen when they do in the political, social, and I would argue ultimately the moral realm in these societies. And the answer that I'm offering, and in which I believe, is that the difference between economic growth and stagnation for the great majority of the population has something to do with it. To repeat, it's not that all of the racists all of a sudden go away, or all of a sudden an economic downturn triggers racism when it wasn't there before. That's not the point. The point is that certain tendencies are always there, but they're not always dominant in the political sphere. Now, the caller mentioned Germany and had some things to say about German national character. I don't want to get into that issue. But the point I would remind him of is that as late as 1928, the Nazi Party drew only 2% of the vote in the German national election, 2%. And by the end of 1932, the Nazis were drawing over 30%. They went from being party number 10 in the ordering in a multi-party system to being party number one. And in January of 1933, then Hitler became chancellor, and we know what happened.
And you're suggesting now, what changed in those years is the economy.
Something happened between 1928 and 1933, and we know what it was. And it wasn't that suddenly the German national character changed. If German national character were all you needed to know about, then why in the world did the Nazi Party draw only 2% of the vote in 1928?
Here's a listener in the United States in 2013 saying, I hope you don't walk into false equivalency here in the American arena, that both sides, Astra writes, are somehow to blame. This listener says, rather, the Republican Party has unilaterally polarized itself. What about this resistance to drawing an equivalency within this context of tough economic times?
I have a lot of sympathy with what your caller is saying, but that's a different matter, and I'm not prepared to comment on that professionally.
But your theory suggests that, you know, you turn up or turn whatever, turn the economy bad and everybody becomes less open, flexible, reasonable, filled with sunlight. And so the listener's pushing back against this equivalency in, you know, in sort of blame for where we stand right now.
I think there is a serious partisan debate to be had in the United States, and I'm not particularly interested in participating in it per se. Just this morning, for example, the front page story of the New York Times was about Democrats who are not prepared, Democrats in the U.S. Senate who are not prepared to vote for gun control. I'm old enough to remember the civil rights debates of the 1950s and 60s, and I remember that at that time it was not the Republican Party in those days that was the impediment to moving forward, giving black people their rights. It was the Southern Democrats. And so there is indeed a debate to be had about which party is either more admirable or more opprobrious today, depending upon which way you want to look at it. But that isn't what I was writing about.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about slow growth, hard times, and our ugly politics right now. My guest, Benjamin Friedman, Harvard economist, says they're all linked. Good times, good politics. Bad times, bad politics. And here we are. Well, if that's true, how do we break out? The president with his big inaugural speech this week, and certainly lots of response to that on both sides of the divide or paralysis, call it what you will, in Washington. Here on Monday with MSNBC's Ed Schultz, Minnesota Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison.
This was a progressive speech. It was a speech that any progressive could say, That's what I'm talking about. I found myself spontaneously cheering in the middle of the speech. It was the kind of speech that made me feel really good, because he combined our common humanity, combined our need for economic fairness, combined the idea that, you know, better days are coming if we will step up to them and meet them.
Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison delighted with that speech. House Speaker John Boehner on Tuesday, not so much.
We're expecting here over the next 22 months to be the focus of this administration as they attempt to annihilate the Republican Party. And let me just tell you, I do believe that is their goal, to just shove us into the dustbin of history.
And people looking on and saying, wait a minute, let's work together and make this work. Here's in Davos yesterday, where the big annual meeting is going on, CEO of J.P. Morgan Management Assets, Mary Callahan Erdos, telling CBS News the U.S. economy is poised to be strong, but the squabbling in Washington, says this banker, is holding it back.
The U.S. has to realize it's got so much going for it. Let's just get ourselves to come together as a team, one team running the country, helping that country to get itself back on stable footing, which then cascades to the rest of the world.
Or cascades in the opposite direction, in a bad direction, if things don't pull together. Benjamin Friedman is with me here in the studio. With us right now from Washington is Jonathan Miller. Joins us actually from Lexington, Kentucky, co-founder of No Labels. It's a nonprofit group of Democrats, Republicans, Independents aiming to break the gridlock. He's former state treasurer of Kentucky, Democrat. Jonathan Miller, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom. I'm a longtime listener, first-time interviewee.
Wonderful to have you. You've heard a bit of our conversation today, and you've no doubt been reading. Everybody's talking these days about Benjamin Friedman's thesis. I mean, first of all, do you think he's right, that bad economies just make it hard to get good things done, and that's where we stand right now? And if that's the case, how do we get out of it?
You know, I think Mr. Friedman is correct. I think that economist that you're the CEO you quoted from Davos just a second ago, mm-hmm. and that soundbite is correct. We have a broken system. Congress right now is so unpopular that Brussels sprouts and Lindsay Lohan are slightly more popular, and it's just more slightly more popular than root canals and communism.
Yep.
So it's a broken system, and we at No Labels believe that it really is up to the people get our leaders to get back on the right track. You know, Mr. Friedman was right on point when he's talking about the growth in Patriot membership. There is a growth in folks on the right wing, whether it's the NRA or folks on the left wing, whether it's the AARP. A lot of opportunities to get involved in organizations that are often opposed to compromise. And so we came along, No Labels, a couple years ago and said, you know, a majority of Americans would like to see bipartisan problem solving. And so we formed this group, and now we've got hundreds of thousands of Democrats, Republicans, Independents, liberals, conservatives, and everybody in the middle who is putting together this grassroots movement to put pressure on our leaders to come together, to understand that compromise isn't a dirty word, and that only through bipartisan problem solving will we tackle these enormous issues, the economy being what's on everyone's mind.
Jonathan, is the AARP now left-wing, your equivalent to armed militias?
Maybe I'll step back from that a second. I think the AARP does a wonderful service, but I do also think that there are groups like the AARP that are making similar arguments to get folks not to compromise on issues like entitlement reform.
What about the idea that you and others trying to get something going here, maybe sort of prisoners of economics, prisoners of history, or at least the history we're in the midst of right now, that the economy just ain't great, and so you're not going to get the people that you want to turn to crank up, you know, the comedy and goodwill. You're not going to get them to do that in this kind of environment.
I think we can, because our polling shows that a vast majority of Americans want their leaders to engage in problem solving. They might be liberal, they might be conservative, but they don't like this current situation in Congress where you got Democrats hiding behind bunkers and Republicans hiding behind their bunkers and not talking to each other. And so we encourage people, whether you're left, right, or anywhere somewhere in the middle, the GoNoLabels.org, and if you like the agenda we're pursuing, help us build our army, because when we go from hundreds of thousands to millions, then that's when Congress can no longer ignore us.
Professor Friedman, how do you look at the mission that Jonathan Miller and his group are on in a time of such a tough economy? Does that mean they're just going to beat their heads against the wall? How do you get out of this trap where bad economy, bad politics, how do you break free of that?
Well, first of all, you never want to think that the economics is all determinative. Mm-hmm. So is there a point in what he is trying to do? Yes, of course there is. It's interesting to realize, though, that even the vocabulary that we use to talk about these things changes depending on the economic circumstances. Here we are talking about interest groups. My suspicion is that if the economy were thriving and growing and people were getting ahead, we would be talking about civil society and the role that various groups, like some of the ones that have just been mentioned, play, and we would be hailing that as a good thing, in the same way that we now look at our paralyzed economic system. And when times are good, what we talk about is checks and balances. And we used to feel good about checks and balances. Now we say, what a check and balance means is that some party or other has the opportunity to block the system.
To thwart. I mean, but you're willing to concede that economics isn't destiny. Okay. But you're also asserting that it's very powerful in setting the context. What's the best escape hatch to look for here?
From an economic perspective, the two best prospects we have of moving our economy forward, not just tomorrow, not just next year, but over the next, say, generation.
And our politics along with it, I presume you mean.
I believe, would be forming and helping to develop our human capital as well as our physical capital.
And Education and infrastructure.
Those are two very different assignments. Human capital, we're talking about the education system. And I would love to sit here and tell you that what we need to do is to shower more money on the Harvards of the world. But the truth of the matter is that what's really broken in this country is K through 12 education. And in our system, that's not a federal matter. This is a matter for 14,000 school districts all across the country. By contrast, when we turn to our physical capital, it's not just infrastructure. Infrastructure needs to be rebuilt, but that's the small part of the problem. The issue is whether American business is going to be able to and have the incentive to put in place the factories and machinery and do the research that's going to make American workers productive. And in an economy where the net saving that's done by families and businesses is only of the order of 8 to 10% of our total economy, if the government is going to be borrowing 8, 10, 15% of the national product because the Medicare problem is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger over time, we are not going to be able to do the physical investment we need either.
So where we stand right now, we can't get agreement on doing it. You suggest maybe we don't have the resources to do it. Benjamin Friedman says, because we're in hard times. Well, listeners, what do you think? Marguerite, Jamaica Plain is calling. Marguerite, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I don't disagree with most of what Professor Friedman is saying, but I do question how he would explain what happened in the New Deal. Certainly hard times in the U.S., and yet there was a great expansion of social policies and a great cohesion in the country generally.
That's a terrific question. I mean, look, Social Security born right in the heart of the New Deal, lots of things done then, and those were what we used to describe the hardest of times, Professor.
Yes, your listener is absolutely right. This is an extremely interesting counterexample. It goes the wrong way from the perspective of the broad ideas that I've been talking about this morning and about which I wrote in my book. And I found this sufficiently interesting that in the book, rather than try to sweep it under the rug, I even highlighted exactly what your listener has flagged. There's a chapter that's titled Great Depression, Great Exception, because I found it so interesting. It absolutely goes the wrong way. And the one suggestion I would make that is not very comforting at the moment is that in the Great Depression of the 30s, people did have a sense of everybody going down together. There were stories, presumably exaggerated, of Wall Street tycoons jumping out of the 20th floor windows.
Right.
There were pictures in the paper of these obviously formerly successful businessmen selling apples on the street. Today, I think everybody understands that we are not all in this together. I mentioned before that in the period of the last decade before the financial crisis hit, there was no increase to speak of in the median family's income. That's not because the total economy wasn't growing. Mm-hmm. It was growing at about 2.5% per annum, which isn't bad by our standards. The problem there was that the fruits of that growth were all accruing to a very small group of people who were pretty much already at the top. So was the 1930s a counterexample? You bet it was. Your listener is very acute and absolutely on target. I don't pretend to know everything about why the 30s were such a counterexample, but there's one crucial aspect of what happened in the 30s that just isn't present today.
They were all in it together. Yes, yeah, absolutely. Jonathan Miller, how about it? Do you see a role model in the New Deal? Did you hear President Obama leaning that way in his term two inaugural? Or, you know, which is basically, I mean, FDR, you know, put a flag in the ground and charged hard toward it. It was a very liberal agenda. Are you recommending that, or are you just saying, well, no, let's compromise? Is that really possible when you start from such polarization?
You know, I think it is, because when it comes to the parties and the leaders in Washington, there is extraordinary hyper-partisanship and polarization. But when it comes to people, when you ask them what's really on their minds, there is so much more common ground than there is polarization. What FDR did so effectively was mobilize that American spirit, made people feel we were all part of one team. And I think, in a sense, while Obama's speech was, quote, liberal or mm-hmm. progressive, mm-hmm. it also was about getting folks charged up and active. That was the conclusion of his speech. Some read it as a mobilization of Democratic liberal armies. I read it as a mobilization of American people. I mean, right now, there are a lot of people who are so skeptical and cynical about the system that they're sitting on their hands and they just have given up. And what we're at No Labels are saying is take up Barack Obama's charge, even if you don't agree with his underlying policies. Get involved in political matters. And again, if you agree with us that you'd like to see our leaders working together and reforming Washington and fixing these problems, you know, come to NoLabels.org and join our army, because we could really use you.
Benjamin Friedman, what about this appeal, in hard economic times, to common sense, common ground, compromise? What prospects?
The economics make it a lot harder. Mr. Miller is right from the public opinion polling that people would like to see the partisan stalemate in Washington go away. But, you know, our own Barney Frank made a very wise comment once many years ago. Barney once said that lots of people complain about partisan bickering and want it to go away. But what most of them usually mean by that is everybody who disagrees with me should shut up, and then the bickering will go away.
Yeah.
Now, that's obviously, just listening to him, not what Mr. Miller is for, mm-hmm. but I wonder, when I read these public opinion polls about how the public is so tired of Washington gridlock and absence of compromise, I wonder whether Barney's insight isn't what it's really all about.
Benjamin Friedman says economic growth is the key to loosening things up, getting things in positive motion. What do you think? And if so, how do we get there? Elin is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Elin. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. We're all talking about this economic growth and moving forward. And Mr. Friedman had alluded to this earlier about a generation wanting their children to have more than they had, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I do think there is a limit. And I don't think, from an environmental standpoint, I'm not so sure that we can continue to move forward in the fashion we have up till now. And I think, especially for the baby boomers, which I'm on the leading edge of that, mm-hmm. I I haven't joined AARP because I see them as wanting to maintain the lifestyle they've always maintained. And I don't think the baby boomers should be expecting that.
Maybe the very physical, environmental context for this whole debate is shifting, you say, Elin. Our time is short, but Benjamin Friedman, what do you say? You talk about the moral consequences of economic growth right in your title. Elin's looking at the environment and saying maybe we're at the limits of growth. Maybe we can't use that as our expansion joint now.
I think you have to be more granular in addressing environmental issues, and this may be what the caller has in mind. In brief, people often talk about three aspects of environmental degradation or damage done by economic growth. One is the idea of we're going to run out of things, so-called peak oil. There's no evidence for this. If we run out of things, they will become scarce and we will use less of them. But there's nothing we're running out of. Second, people often mean things like clean air and clean water. Turns out that the dirty air and dirty water in the world is not in countries like ours. The worst air I've ever breathed is in Mumbai.
But it is certainly in countries with high economic growth. China.
I disagree. It's in countries where the economic level of income
has not... Beijing last week.
Beijing is a very good example. They're getting to the point at which they're now at about the level at which most countries start to put catalytic converters on their cars. The issue that's going to be most difficult to address is the climate change. I think that's very, very, very hard issue. But to conclude, I think the real issue is whether we're in a trap, whether the problem is that our absence of economic growth is leading to our political paralysis, and because of the political paralysis, we're unable to take those steps that would restore economic growth.
There's our question for today. Benjamin Friedman, great to have you with us. Jonathan Miller with No Labels. Thank you to you both and to listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.